Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. What is wrong with that? I'd like to know, too. There's nothing wrong with that, because listening to Beatles music on a lovely Monday evening or Tuesday afternoon is exactly what you get to do, and you get to hear it sung by that magical voice of Michael Mahler. Welcome to this week's Behind the Curtain, everybody. This is Paul Listick, and I'll be chatting a couple of upcoming theater events we want you to know about. We're going to start with Silly Love Songs, which is Michael Mahler sings Paul McCartney over at the Marriott Theater on March 9th and 10th. Thing about Michael is, if you're not familiar with him, you probably are. You just don't realize it, because he is the composer of works like Miracle the Musical, right? Maybe you saw that over at the Royal George, The Secret of My Success out at the Paramount, October Sky, Hero. I can go on and on, but let's get him involved in the conversation. If I do his credentials, we'll never get to him. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Paul. Good to talk to you.
And to think I've known you for a very long time. You and I go back to when I think you were just starting out as an actor, pretty much.
Absolutely, yeah, the bailiwick.
So when did the composer, the writing all these great shows, because, and there's some other stuff I'm going to bring up with you, too, that I didn't mention, but when did this hit, or was it always in you, but acting was the place to start in Chicago?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I was always a musical person. My parents are both singers and musicians and actors, actually. So I sort of couldn't escape it. It was doomed from the start.
It also meant you had support, right? As opposed to a lot of people who say, "I want to go be an actor." No.
No, I was very lucky. They never said, "Were you really sure you don't want to do something else?" They always were
accounting
extremely supportive. Yeah. Well, exactly. Some days I wonder if they should have, but they were very supportive. So yeah, from an early age, I was singing and acting and playing piano and guitar. And I wrote songs for my band in high school, and I was acting, when I was a kid, but I never really started writing theater songs until I got to college and started writing at Northwestern for the WAMU show. And it kind of started there, and I kept doing both ever since, really, acting and playing in bands and writing shows. It's always been sort of all at the same time.
You probably wake up some mornings and just go, "I can't believe this is my life. This is what I do."
I do feel very lucky, yeah. And I feel very lucky to get to do it here in Chicago, where, someone like me can find avenues to do all the things I want to do. I don't have to get shoved into one box or another box and just do one specific thing. I can sort of explore all sorts of different things, and the city is able to support that and celebrate that, which is really, really, really awesome.
So when you have hits like Miracle the Musical, I know you had some collaborators in that, but an October Sky and Hero, some of these incredible shows, which, again, I'm sure people have seen, just didn't maybe not tie your name to it. But I want to ask you about something different, because you also get a writing credit, a contributing lyricist credit for the Broadway and London revival of Miss Saigon. How does that happen? Because that means you wrote a song for Miss Saigon. I mean, Miss Saigon is, what is it, maybe 30 years old now. It was been around forever. Right. How does one, do you like write a song and say, "Hey, by the way, guys, I've got something you should have had in that show 30 years ago." How did that happen?
Oh, it was really, it was like everything in this business is sort of connections upon connections. I worked a lot with David Bell, who's a director in town. He directed Hero, and we wrote Newt Rockne together. And he had a connection to those guys, and we started working together on an adaptation of their show, La Révolution Française, that they wrote before Les Mis, that had never been done in English. And they said, "Well, we need a lyricist." And David said, "I know just the guy," and threw my name in the hat. And we started working together on that. They liked what I was doing. And at the same time we were working on that, they were working with Cameron McIntosh on putting together a new production of Miss Saigon. And they said, "Well, hey, we want to revisit some of these lyrics and see if we can update the show a little bit. And we have this guy we like working with. And so I got to be on board that crazy train. That was a really, really, really cool experience.
That is amazing. I mean, to work with those talented people. Have you called like Andrew Lloyd Webber and just said, dude, I've got some suggestions for Phantom you might want to work in?
No, but if you have his number, you know, pass it along.
No, but I know somebody who worked with him, so we might be able to get you to him.
We'll
talk about some of that stuff. Let's get on to what it is you're about to do March 9th and 10th, 7:30 at night on the 9th and 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the 10th. I imagine those might be for some retired folks or other folks who are free out at the Marriott. Michael Mahler sings Paul McCartney. One of the things I didn't know about you, I probably should have, but you're like a Beatlemaniac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a long time. I was big into the Beatles in junior high and have sort of been insane about them ever since. So when somebody like Michael Ingersoll calls and says, do you want to put together a show singing Paul McCartney songs, you jump at the chance.
And I you mentioned Michael Ingersoll. People may know his name. He was in the Jersey Boys, so he played that. Also, what he and right. his wife, Angela, who's well known for her performances as Judy Garland. Everybody's got a million hats right. and reasons to know everybody around Chicago. But I interviewed him on WGN Radio this morning about what they've created, something called Artists Lounge Live, which you can see at artistloungelive.com. And that's kind of who's booking the show for it. Can you talk to me about that venture, what their mission is, and how you get involved with that?
Oh, it's so cool and so uniquely Chicago. I mean, he's putting together shows like, you know, he was in Jersey Boys, so he did that for a long time, and then he was
under
the Street Lamp group, which was sort of doing oldies, you know, in like a show format. And he said, you know, we have all this amazing talent in Chicago, like why not start pairing people up with artists that they admire and can kind of emulate and create a whole bunch of different shows to keep them working, to, you know, satisfy a niche in the audience. And it's a cool, unique kind of thing. You know, I'm not out there, I'm not doing like a Paul McCartney impression. You know, I don't put on like the mop top wig and do the whole bit. It's just really about, it's like somewhere in between that and like cabaret, you know, it's storytelling. It's you got to get a sense of the songs of what Paul was. I tell stories about what he was sort of going through when he wrote them. I talk about looking at it as a songwriter myself and sort of watching him develop and seeing the influences and the way he and John work together. So, you know, people come to it, they learn a little bit about me. They maybe learn something about Paul McCartney they didn't know before, and they get to hear some really incredible songs.
And now, of course, with you, I have to ask, so have you met McCartney? Does he know you're doing this?
Oh, gosh, no. If you have his number. Well. You know, I've seen him a few times in concert, but never got to meet him. But that's definitely on my bucket list.
I would think it would be. So we opened up with Silly Love Songs, which is what you call this show or this tribute,
right.
just to tap into, because obviously it's not just a McCartney in concert through Michael Mahler. It's we're learning a little bit. So can you share a little bit about something of McCartney? Maybe it's tied to Silly Love Songs, if there's a song to it, because that is one of the more silly things he's done. Do we know why he wrote that, where that came from?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a cool story. You know, he sort of got pigeonholed, you know, throughout the years as being kind of the sweet Beatle and the, like, you know, the soft one. You know, John was this hard-edged, you know, rock and roller, and people sort of forget that Paul wrote some of their craziest hardcore songs, you know, like he wrote Helter Skelter. He sort of really led them on the path to, like, some of that crazy experimentation that they were doing in Sgt. Pepper in those old days, like, He was definitely not the sort of sweet, squeaky clean guy that he was made out to be. But, you know, it was 1976, I think he wrote the song, and John, I think, had written something else in the press about, like, Paul and his granny music and his, you know, his, like, his silly love songs that don't mean anything.
Right.
And he said, you know what? Like, who cares? You know what I mean? If people are enjoying this music, if it makes people smile, then, like, what is wrong with that? Why not enjoy, you know, a beautiful melody every once in a while? Why not sort of forget about your cares for 2 minutes or however long it is, 4.5 minutes on the radio, and just put a smile on your face. And actually, Silly Love Songs, like, was a number one hit for him. It was the last number one hit.
So in some ways, McCartney wrote it as a response to John?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a retort. And, like, you know, then it went to number one. So I guess
he wins.
People do have a little bit of an ear for Silly Love Songs
yeah.
on them.
Now, is the McCartney, are the songs we're going to go, are they going to go back to Beatles songs like Yesterday that McCartney wrote? Or do you staying with the post-Beatles era of McCartney music?
Oh, no, we're starting back with the Beatles days and going all the way through. Yeah, there's lots of Beatles songs we're doing and some post-Beatles songs, some Wing songs. You know, I mean, it's such an amazing songbook from start to finish, and the way he was able to tap into something so so profound at such an early age is really incredible. I mean, when you think about it, he wrote yesterday when he was, what, like 21 years old? I mean, geez Louise.
Yeah, right. And of course, oh, now I got to challenge you with a little trivia. See, my brother's a huge Beatles nut, and there's a show called Collectors Call, which featured me last season. And this season, they're featuring my brother in his Beatles collection. So we just live the Beatles around him. But basically, and you know this, I'm sure, but do you know what the original name of the song Yesterday was?
Oh, yeah, Scrambled Eggs.
Right.
Oh, my baby, how I love your legs. Da-da-da-da-da-da, Scrambled Eggs.
So glad I couldn't throw you.
That was an example of like a good quality rewrite. You know?
Yeah, right.
You don't always get it exactly right the first time.
Well, as a songwriter yourself, would you guess that as a songwriter, would you say it wasn't that he wanted those to be the lyrics? Sometimes you need filler lyrics in. You have this melody you're working on and you just need some, even if it's nonsense lyrics. Do you do that?
For sure. Yeah. You just sort of mumble something and then eventually it becomes something real. But the cool story about Yesterday is right. He had this melody sort of fully formed in his head when he woke up one day, and he went down and he wrote it out and he like played it perfectly on the piano, and he was like, "This is so good. It must be something else. It must be something that I heard somewhere and that I'm just copying." So he went around and played it for everybody he could and sang, you know, Scrambled Eggs, blah 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 blah, right. Your legs, and everyone was like, "No, that's yours, man. That's original."
I love it.
Kind of an incredible story.
Well, tell me some of the songs. Well, I just want to do a couple of them just so people get a sense of what the evening is like with you or the afternoon on the 10th. Hey Jude.
Right.
We all know the song Hey Jude. We're all, when he does it in concert, we're all singing along with him. But where did it come from?
Oh, that's a really beautiful story, actually. His friend John Lennon, you know, you may have heard of him.
I've heard of him, yeah.
going through a divorce with Cynthia, his first wife, so he could marry Yoko. And his son with Cynthia, Julian, was kind of getting a little bit lost in the shuffle. You know, John was sort of focused on his new relationship and not really spending a lot of time with Julian. And Paul, who didn't have kids at the time and wasn't married yet, was like big into kids and was like really good with Julian, actually. Like he was like, they had a really good connection. And so he sort of saw what was going on, saw what Julian was going through, and he wanted to write a song to sort of make him feel better and comfort him in like a hard time. And so, you know, he took Julian, Hey Jules, and turned it into Hey Jude, and the rest is history.
Which means, like, if Lennon had named his kid Bob, we'd be singing Hey Bob?
Hey Bob, yeah. Or did you see that movie Yesterday that just came out?
I did, yeah.
Like, what would happen? Yeah, or Hey Dude.
Right.
You know? It could be
right.
A very different history.
I love it. And one more, just because I know you do it, and it's so classic, but Let It Be.
Yeah.
What's the story of Let It Be?
Well, the Beatles were breaking up. You know, it was 1969. They were all kind of pulling in different directions, going their separate ways. And Paul's 28 years old, thinking like, well, my life is over. You know, I've conquered the world with my band and become the most successful songwriter of all time. And now I'm 28 and it's all over. You know, what a shame. But he had this dream, actually. He really did. He had a dream, and his mother, who had passed away when he was 14, from cancer, her name is Mary, and he said she came to him in the dream and said, "Paul, everything's going to be fine. You're going to be okay. You're going to get through it. You just have to let it be." And so he woke up. He took that message that he got, you know, maybe from heaven, maybe from his subconscious, who knows? But he turned it into an anthem, really, that, you know, has become such an important song in so many people's lives and brought so much comfort to so many people.
You mean if his mom's name was Blanche, it would be Mother Blanche Came to Me?
Exactly. Mother Trudy came to me. True. You know? It could be anything.
Do you see, this is the kind of analysis I like to bring to these kinds of problems. This is, you know.
Really, yes. Groundbreaking, really. What else could the name be?
It'll have you completely rethink the approach you're taking. While I've got
That's
you,
right.
We got to talk, since you have another little project going on, Secret of My Success over at the Paramount Theater, and although I probably will talk about that, you know, show some other time with the cast of that, but you're the composer. That was the old famous Michael J. Fox film. And by the
That's
way,
right.
Chris Jones, which gave it a quite a good review, but he really singled out your music and talked about what an incredible score it is. So just let people know about Secret of My Success, what it's about, and maybe where that project came from.
It's like you said, it's a Michael J. Fox movie from the 80s. It's a Universal Pictures property. And I had worked with Universal before on October Sky, as you mentioned, and so I had a good relationship with them. And I actually wrote the song for that show with my partner Alan Schmuckler. We write together occasionally, and more these days. But yeah, the idea came down the pike. Gordon Greenberg, the director and book writer, and his book writing partner, Steve Rosen, had this idea for a way to modernize the story and make it feel relevant to today. You know, it's sort of, it's kind of a fun farce. It's the guy, Michael J. Fox's character, is a young guy trying to make it in business, and he gets fired on his first day on the job. And so to sort of get back in there, he pretends to be this junior executive. He dresses up in a nice suit, you know, and fools everyone in the office into thinking he's this other guy. And he sort of, you know, you follow him, and he falls in love with another junior analyst, and but she thinks he's the guy he's pretending to be. So, you know, hijinks ensue.
Right.
But we, you know, we saw it as really a chance to, like, really examine questions about what is success today. You know, is it still the idea of, like, making your millions? Is it that sort of self-made man mentality, or is it something else? Does it become something different? Is it really about valuing your integrity and who you are as a human being and your roots and your real identity? You know, it seems like that kind of question never goes out of style, and it feels like today an even more important question to continue to ask ourselves. So it's sort of about that, and it's also a hilarious, you know, musical comedy in the best sense of the word.
So, you know, as you describe it, for me, it sounds like the 80s, Secret of My Success, was almost an update of playing around with the 60s, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. The great Robert.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sort of curious. So when we see it now, is it the feeling of the 80s, or have you now updated it to the 2000 teens anyway, or 20, so that it's more of a current flavor, or do we play it in the 80s?
We played today. Yeah, we've updated it. So it's an update of an update of an update. And you know, as we've been working on it, it's been really a fascinating sort of journey to the stage. And as we've been working on it for a number of years. And as the conversation around gender in the office and around, you know, office relationships and what lines are no longer, have never been okay to cross, but are really now, you know, the conversation is sort of bringing certain things into the light in a wonderful way. It's sort of made us sort of really, you know, question, like, what about this is able to sort of be laughed at anymore? And we've sort of had to sort of find really interesting new ways to look at these relationships. Actually, it's kind of like a post Me Too musical comedy. And I think that alone sort of has made it a really cool piece of its time. You know, it's not shying away from those issues, but it's sort of finding a way to really to tackle it head on in still a way that we can laugh at, that we can all, you know, that we aren't going to, like, go, ooh, this is gooey, but we're going to say, like, oh, this is fun, and I can enjoy this, and I'm having a good time.
So Secret of My Success, that's playing at the Paramount Theater in Aurora through March 29th, and I encourage people to go see that. Again, you came on here to talk about the McCartney thing, but you did write the thing, so I think it's worth talking about that. And listen, there's a lot of talk of it going to Broadway, so I'll certainly wish you well in how that develops over time.
Poo-poo-poo, thank you very much.
Yeah, and right, no poo-poo, right, we don't do that. And you know what, I know some other stuff you're working on, but I never know what can be talked about at one can't. So I'll simply ask you in that way. What other projects are you currently working on that you can talk about?
That I can talk about? That's a great question.
Well, I want to talk about the ones you can't talk about, but you won't do that.
No, I wish I could. I've got, you know, it's an exciting time. There's a lot of things in development right now, but some things that I can't talk about, I'm working on a piece for Chicago Shakespeare Theater with Alice Brookler and this book writer, Chelsea Mercantile. We're doing sort of an update of an adaptation of the Frankenstein story, sort of setting it in the idea of social media as kind of the Frankenstein monster. Like, is it inherently evil? Does it make people evil? Or are we, you know what I mean? Is it just a reflection of something that's already there? So that's coming up. We're in development there, and I'm working on a piece for a writer's theater in Glencoe with a book writer, Randall Colburn, about Jonestown, actually. So a lot of more fun musical comedy coming your way.
Okay. And so the project I'm thinking about, and you know what it is, you can't talk about that yet, right?
I don't think so. No, we haven't quite signed on the dotted line, but hopefully soon we'll be able to.
Okay. Well, let me just say you're working with somebody very exciting, and when that comes to fruition, that'll be an exciting thing to talk about down the line.
Absolutely. Well, you'll have to bring me back on the show.
And you know what? If you want to kind of rework Fiddler on the Roof and kind of bring it up to the 2000s for me, let's do that.
You got it.
You'll make me the 2020.
Right, right. A fiddler on the corrugated, like.
Exactly, right. On the corrugated, corrugated TV station or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, you are just so amazing, Michael, again. And going back with you, as I have to really, I think, the early days in your career and watching you develop over these years has been just so totally amazing. The show, again, is going to be on March 9th at 7:30 p.m. and Tuesday, March 10th at 1 p.m. It's at Marriott Theater out in Lincolnshire, which, by the way, they've got great restaurants there. Every time I go to Marriott, I kind of get some dinner. I get some lunch ahead of time. You really can make it a thing and enjoy your time. Tickets are at Ticketmaster.com. I imagine you can get them through Marriott as well, but they tell me to say Ticketmaster.com. So that's one place you can check out Michael Mahler's show. It's only a couple of performances, so they got to make sure they get into one of those two. And you play in the round. You enjoy playing in the round up there?
I do. I love it. The Marriott has been like an artistic home for me for a long time. So to get to do this show there is going to be really fun.
We're going to
be up close. You know, you're up close and personal with the audience. There's no hiding. And it's nice to have that, like, really intimate connection.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, by the way, we're going to go out playing another song. So give me a little bit of the history of what we'll learn when we hear you sing Blackbird.
Oh, Blackbird. The story of Blackbird is it was when Paul and George were kids. They used to carry their acoustic guitars around to parties, and like they were those guys, you know, to impress girls.
Right.
And they would play this song that they played incorrectly. It's a piece by Bach. It's that bourre that goes da 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 da. You know, you've probably heard it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it sort of featured like a running line on top and like a moving bass line with the thumb, and that was sort of always their party trick. So then flash forward to 1968, you know, the civil rights movement is at its height, you know, it's sort of everywhere, inescapable. The Beatles are putting together songs for what's going to be the White Album, and Paul is sort of thinking about the civil rights movement and wants to say something about it in a song. But, you know, where John would probably write some big political anthem, you know, sort of like a give peace a chance kind of thing, Paul
right.
being sort of the personal thinker, you know, the sort of character study guy, goes, well, what if I wrote a story about, like, one, you know, African-American woman who was sort of trying to find the strength to fly? And so he sort of created Blackbird by picking up little pieces of that Bach piece and turning it around and playing it differently on the guitar and putting that story to it.
So we'll take a little bit of Michael Mahler singing Blackbird. You will hear him sing it when you see him at Marriott Theater on March 9th and 10th, Ticketmaster.com, or you can go to the box office, contact Marriott as well, and get tickets from there. Michael Mahler, you're incredibly talented. Break legs on this upcoming show, and here's little Mike Mahler singing Blackbird.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your waiting for this moment to arrive. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
Hello, Liza. Hey, hello, Liza. It's so nice to see you here where you belong. You're looking swell, Mama, I can tell. Mama, you're still glowing, you're still crowing, you're still going strong.
Well, that, of course, I'm sure as soon as you heard Hello, Liza, you knew what you were in the middle of. And indeed, there was a very famous concert years ago sung by mother and daughter Judy Garland and Liza Minnelli. And it's known as the London Palladium Concert. In fact, I know there's recordings of it. But what is really amazing, especially if you were too young to have been around or too poor to have gotten yourself to London for it, this is your opportunity, because coming up at the Greenhouse Theater Center, starting on March 5th, playing through April 5th, it's called Judy and Liza, Once in a Lifetime, the London Palladium Concert, a tribute. And I've got with me the two actresses who are playing Judy and Liza. Let's talk about this a little bit. So exciting. Nancy Hayes plays the role of Judy Garland, and Alexa Castelvecchi plays Liza Minnelli, her daughter. And ladies, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Hello.
Nancy, let's start, since you're the mom here, let's start by asking, where did this venture, exist and you guys stepped in and auditioned, or did you, were you part of saying this concert needs to be put on for huge fans of Judy and Liza today?
The idea for the concert came from a different performance. We were doing The Boy from Oz, and Robert Aulis was the musical director of that show, and I played Judy Garland in it. It was produced in Chicago in 2015, and there's a very famous scene within that musical, which is about Peter Allen's life, where they talk about the Palladium concert. And this is really the only time in history that Judy and her daughter performed live in concert. And it was just a remarkable event. And so when we saw that in the scripts, we thought, well, let's research that. That sounds like a really cool program. And then we decided to put it together. And we did an original performance of it a couple years ago at the Uptown Underground. And this is a different theatrical presentation of the same concert, but with some additional things that we've put into it that we think enhance the program even more.
And because, am I right? I'm sure I have the recording of the concert. It's available, right?
Well, there's a CD album of, it's like a two-album set. And then there are YouTube clips. If you go online and you put in Judy and Liza Palladium concert, they're in black and white, and they're pieces. Because, you know, broadcasting then isn't what it is today. But there are segments of songs. So Robert Aulis, who's really brilliant at putting this together, took both of those sources and helped us to put together the concert, as closely as we could in terms of celebrating the music and the transitions and the medleys and just, you know, giving people a sense of what it really was, as well as we can in this day and age for a 1964 concert.
Yeah. So, Alexa, here you are, but you're playing Liza Minnelli. And the thing is, she's still around. She still performs. I've seen her in performance and stuff. So do we get, as we come and see the show, which is soon to open, will we watch and feel like we're seeing Judy and Liza? Or is it like, no, we're not doing an imitation. We're just doing this tribute, but we are us. I mean, as I look at the pictures of you guys promoting it looks like you guys are playing those roles.
Yeah, so I would say it's almost a little bit more of a tribute show where Nancy is bringing Judy to life and Alexa is bringing Liza to life. So we're not completely doing like your stereotypical Vegas Liza, you know. It's not a 100% sort of, I wouldn't say corny, but it's not a replication in any way, shape, or form. We're kind of just reminiscing and bringing back a little bit of their flair and flavor. The songs, however, like Nancy was saying, were arranged by Robert in the way that they're most authentic as possible to how they perform them. And the way we are singing them sort of definitely gives you that taste. However, in between the music, we've sort of introduced ourselves as Nancy and Alexa in order to give the audience a little bit of our life and how they fit in, our lives fit in with Judy and Liza, because there's a lot of parallels, especially with Nancy having played Judy so many times in multiple productions. And one of my first big professional roles was a parody of Liza here in Chicago, which is how they actually found me to play the role, by seeing me up on stage in Andersonville playing a parody of Liza. So I would say we kind of bring a little bit of ourselves to the stage while trying to keep it as authentic as possible.
I tell you, knowing your background, I mean, Nancy, I know you know your work in from MAME to How to Succeed in Business, as you talked about The Boy from Oz and so many things. But one of the things I didn't know was that you performed as an opening act for, it's just one of my favorite duos, but the Smothers Brothers.
Oh, yes. Absolutely, and I adore them. I had so much fun working with them. I got the wonderful privilege of opening for lots of big names. A lot of people Alexa's age may not know who they are.
Oh, but I do. George Burns, Rita Rudner, some great folks.
But the thing that was unique about that era when I did it, which I was a very young person, but then a lot of comedians wanted a singer, a young singer, to open for them because they had bands. So if you think about it, George Burns had a band, Danny Thomas had a band, the Smothers Brothers had a band, Rich Little. All those early comedians, unlike comedians today that usually pair themselves with other comedians, they sort of were more vaudevillian in that they wanted a musical act to open for them, and they incorporated music into their comedy, most of them anyway.
Yeah.
So that's how I got that gig, and it was an incredible one. I was able to open for a lot of legends, and I learned a lot, and Yeah, that's a part of my past I'm very proud of.
And Alexa, part of your work, and I mean, again, so much has been Chicago-based, working with Helena Handbag. They do such great stuff. And I know you haven't danced like with Mario Lopez as Nancy has. I just thought I'd toss that in. But
isn't that awesome?
Is he a good dancer, by the way?
That's a whole nother subject. It's hilarious.
Okay.
He was an excellent dancer, but when he was on Dancing with the Stars, after I did that dance performance appearance with him, he said he had never danced before, and I was just at home laughing, like, oh, come on, Mario, you've danced so many times. That's just hysterical. That's just for showbiz, because he's a great dancer, and he'd had lots of experience doing it before I worked with him, and that was a million years ago, but that's a funny piece of trivia.
And Alexa, you've done a lot of work, I know, in short films, and so you're coming to the stage, although you've been on the stage, but also with a film background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Chicago is a mecca for every art form. And so when I came here from the suburbs, I kind of just wanted to immerse myself and dip my toe in every single water as possible. And so, yeah, I've done a lot of film stuff, which varies completely, like on a different spectrum of how I feel about it and how I approach it. But it's been kind of interesting with this show, for example, the Judy and Liza show, because we've had to take so much of our research from like audio sources, but then there is a little bit of a YouTube clip. It doesn't show the entirety of the show, because there were only parts of it that are on there. I don't know, due to probably, you know, broadcasting things back then. But it's been interesting watching it from an actor's perspective, who is then going to sort of pay tribute to it on stage, versus in that moment when they were being filmed, they were in this ginormous like auditorium. So obviously a lot of the nuances that we are lucky enough to have these YouTube clips to see in their faces and the little gestures that they make to each other, maybe someone in like the nosebleeds at the time at the concert wouldn't have been able to sort of grasp. And what's cool about the space that we're doing the show in is that it's a 58 seat theater. So it's a very intimate setting, and so you really get to know both Nancy and I, as well as our flair of Judy and Liza, because you are so close and you feel immersed in it. And with film, that's usually a lot of times the camera's like in your face, and so it's been kind of fun having to work with a theater this size as well, due to the fact that people are going to see every single little smirk, every smile. They see it all plain and clear because they're, you know, only a few feet away.
And Nancy, I know there are certain people in town, you, Angela Ingersoll, people who have just, you know, play this the Judy Garland role from time to time, but here we add on kind of an extra level, because we've got to be able to feel as though you and Alexa are mother-daughter. How did you prepare to so that when we watch you, we'll get the sense we're getting mother and daughter?
Well, I have four kids, and it's funny you cover Chicago theater. My daughter Caroline has done so many shows in Chicago. My son Matt and actually Eddie, they all married, they've done performing. So I have a performing child background there of my own to pull from. But I think this concert, the reason it's really compelling is that you have a lot of fantastic Judy tributes to Carnegie Hall and to her as a solo artist, like, you know, the wonderful Angela did. But this is a duo show, and it is a mother-daughter relationship. And as Alexa and I have discussed, it's the passing of the torch. Judy is still at a happy period. She did her TV show in 64, so she's not, you're not going to see the depressed Judy. And you're going to be very uplifted by this concert, which puts, you know, I think a nice spotlight on her good parts. But you're also going to see her pass the torch to her daughter, who was only 18 at the time. And you see in this very concert, Liza emerge as a star. And so they're both radiant. They're both together. They're both happy. They are collaborating in all kinds of really cool harmony parts, there is no other concert in history with these two women like this. So I think that experience in and of itself differentiates this concert from any other Garland tribute that you might see, whether it's Renee Zellweger or, you know, any of the other artists that have done it. And it's a great show for mother-daughters, which I think is a big, a big theater-growing crowd, or granddaughters. And just, it's great for all ages. It's not one of those concerts that's like a Rat Pack old skewing thing. It kind of works for no matter what your age group is. And I think that also makes it unique.
And now, let me follow up with you, Nancy and Alexa. I'm going to give you the same question because what you said was really interesting. At the time of this concert in 64, neither of them, of course, had experienced. Well, Judy Garland had some rough times in her past. I mean, even back to the Wizard of Oz days, we know about that. So I'm curious, and Nancy, I'll start with you. But as you get ready to portray Garland, knowing that we are seeing Garland, at, as far as the public knew, at a time of her life where everything was great, but you also know what was to come. Does that inform your performance? What was going to come?
Definitely. I had had the privilege of playing Judy Garland in 8 different productions. So it's funny. I played her, my very first professional role was the role of Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz at the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan when I was still a teenager. So I have played her in many, many different productions throughout my lifetime. And I feel I've kind of aged along with her. Hopefully I'll have a little happier future than she had, you know, when she sadly passed away at too young an age. But I feel like there is a transition in the show, too. You're going to see that if you were to Google, and people do this after they see our concert, they go back and look at the YouTube clips, and they're just a little bit freaked out because I think we've done an excellent job of capturing them. But you'll see Judy transition during the show. She realizes that her daughter is going to be a star. Really, kind of, you'll see this transformation in the concert. And then by the end of it, she's a little bit melancholy because she kind of is joyful that she sees the future, but she also sees her future, which wasn't going to be a bright one. And the very climax of the show is just, I don't want to give it away, but this is exactly what you're getting at. You do sense that Judy is heading into a period from here on that may not be the brightest, but there is a bright future behind her, and that's Liza Minnelli. And so it is interesting.
Yeah, and Alexa, you know, Liza too has absolutely had her rough days, you know, in those years that followed. How does it inform your performance? Or does it, because she's so young there, she hasn't experienced it?
Honestly, what I think is refreshing about this version of Liza is that was not even a thought in her mind. I mean, I think she saw her mother's struggles and she, you know, felt for that. And she definitely, that like resonated with her. But in terms of sort of seeing what could play out in terms of maybe the more negative aspects of her future, I don't think that was even a thought in her mind because she was still so young and she was extremely inexperienced, naive during this concert. She was 18 years old. It was her first like big concert appearance. I mean, she was on stage with a legend, which was her mother. So you can imagine that pressure was out of this world. But I think everyone in the audience comes to find how she sort of deals with that throughout the concert and how the two of them, you know, like as Nancy was saying throughout the concert, Judy comes to the realization that she is passing this torch. And I think Liza accepts that. And the two of them finish very strong for that reason, even though it's a little bittersweet of a moment. But as an 18-year-old, I don't think she had any of those sort of thoughts in mind. She had too much ahead of her to worry about, I think. Oh. And so not too much of that craziness that her life sort of tumbled into is evident, I would say. It's a little bit more of just the fresh, young approach.
I'm curious, did either of you get to meet, I had the pleasure of going backstage to meet her at White Christmas, Lorna Luft, Judy's other daughter, Liza's half-sister, were in town. Did any of you, either of you see White Christmas or meet Lorna?
Oh, no, we didn't get to do that. That would have been amazing.
That would and Nancy, I'm about to make you a little jealous because, in fact, when I told Lorna this, she just kind of shook her head and went, whoa, which is this? And I've actually shown this on our WGN Morning Show, which you guys appeared on, right?
Yes, with Dean Richards.
Exactly. So people can go online and check that clip out. But anyway, I have Judy's glove from her concert at the Palace.
What?
And some music that she arranged that she signed. And Lorna was intrigued, and I brought that when Angela Ingersoll did her performance at Porchlight of End of the Rainbow. I did a talk back afterwards, and I brought that with let Angela sort of hold it for a while, which is somebody who plays Judy. I think we need to arrange that so you can hold it. You should wear it during this concert and tell Liza to get away from your glove.
Whoa, that is way cool.
That's incredible.
I'm so excited.
So, you know what? Wow. If I may just bring it with me when I come see the show, and I'll see you.
Oh, my God.
See you ladies
Please
afterwards.
Do. Oh, that is an honor. And
wow, that's fantastic.
I think it'll inspire me.
Well, it should. Sure. I love it. I love it. Well, the show is Judy and Liza, the London Palladium Concert, this tribute, which, again, having heard the music, I just can almost see it in my head play out, but I'm looking forward to seeing it while it plays March 5th through April 5th at the Greenhouse Center Theater. You can get tickets at greenhousetheater.org/Judy. Judy and Liza tickets. They could make that a little easier, but it is what it is. greenhousetheater.org/Judy and Liza tickets. You know what? I want to hear a little bit more of you guys. We do get Over the Rainbow. I mean, all those hits that you wanted to hear Judy or Liza sing, you do sing in this show, right? I know it. I've seen a list of many of them.
There are so many huge songs in this show that are just classics of Judy's. And then there are other ones like the one that Marvin Hamlisch wrote for Liza in this show that are going to sound fresh, but they are every bit as fantastic as the Judy standards, you know?
Yeah.
So you're going to get both. And then you'll get all those harmonies, which I think is, you know, another enhancement.
And we will go out
Definitely
with a little.
Our favorite.
We'll go out with a little of that as we hear Judy and Liza in the form of Nancy and Alexa singing together wherever we go.
Wherever we go, whatever we do, we're gonna go through it together. We may not go far, but sure as a star, wherever we are, it's together. Wherever I go, I know she goes. Wherever I go, I know she goes. No fit, no fight, no feud, and no egos. Amigos, together.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.